Across Australia, it's Nightlife with Tony Delroy. It's Nightlife.
Australians travelling abroad are increasingly likely to arrive back home carrying a range of intestinal bugs and parasites in their stomachs. If you've had barley belly or picked up something unsavoury in the third world, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about tonight. Some are easy to get rid of with a dose of antibiotics, but others are quite difficult to diagnose and very difficult to treat, with some now appearing resistant to antibiotics. Tonight we're going to take a look at some of the big challenges facing our guts and at some of the breakthrough ways that they're being treated. Very fortunate tonight to have one of the world leaders in intestinal diseases in studio, Professor Tom Barodi, the gastroenterologist who pioneered antibiotic treatment of ulcers, the fecal transplant, and also generated quite a reputation for his pioneer treatment of parasites. Tom, great to see you tonight. Thanks for being there. Let's just talk through a few definitions to start with. What's the difference between parasite, bugs, and bacteria? Can you define those for us?
Well, parasites are fairly large animals.
Yep.
Compared to a bacterium. A parasite might be compared to a bus, a bacterium to a golf ball. So you can see it under a microscope far more easily than you can see a bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
Viruses are even tinier. I mean, they can enter a bacterium. They can get into the golf ball like a dot on the end of a pen.
That's pretty scary. How common are parasites in the Australian population?
Not a common occurrence, perhaps 10 to 15% of the population. And the most common one is Blastocystis hominis. Number two is Dientamoeba fragilis. And in themselves, they cause minor symptoms, but still they're quite a nuisance.
Can you tell us a little bit about both of those? They're pretty hard to say, but can you tell us exactly what they cause and how they play out?
Well, Blastocystis hominis, you can pick it up in water supplies such as tank water, or you go camping somewhere and you might drink water from a stream. But it's also picked up from dogs, and pets may have Blastocystis hominis. There was a study in Queensland that showed this. And generally speaking, you may have two or three members of the family infected, and the only complaints may be no complaints or increased gas or a bit of diarrhea, cramping, urgency. And then someone does a stool test and there is Blastocystis. And it's this big name faces you. Mm. Oh, no, I've got blasto, you know.
Yeah. I mean, how does it pass between dog and human?
I don't want to say, but it is fecal-oral spread. So dogs must excrete the bacteria, the parasites on the fur or somewhere like that. A child picks it up or an adult picks it up, or it may be attached to furniture. But it's just spread directly, fecal-oral spread, it's called.
Okay. What about the other one, fragilis?
Dientamoeba fragilis. And that's more associated with children bringing in from school and to do with pinworms. And often these things can be picked up on a school wall where children have been touching dirty hands, again, fecal-oral spread. And so D. fragilis is associated with pinworm and pinworm spread. So say we have a patient who works with children in daycare, they're likely to have D. fragilis spread from the child to that adult. And they cause a bit more than blasto. In fact, there are several cases where actual colitis was caused by D. fragilis, very mild colitis, published papers on that.
Being young children, obviously, their immune systems are a little bit weak, and so therefore it could be quite devastating, I guess.
I don't know if we can say specifically that the immune system is weak. It's a little bit different, and it's being exposed to various new products, new bugs. But they tend to touch and eat and contact more things that we would not, you know, and they can crawl and pick up cockroaches, etc. So a lot of things go into the mouth there, so they're more likely to bring that home from school as well.
Yeah. Are they hard to detect?
They are, particularly Dientamoeba fragilis. The average pathology lab won't find it because you need a special container that has a fixative in it, SA fixative, and then a trained parasitologist who knows how to stain with this iron hematoxylin stain. And they're very tiny, And so you need a trained eye, yes, a parasitologist who is trained in Diff fragilis detection.
So you probably find those in major teaching hospitals and the like, but you wouldn't find it in your average country hospital, for example.
Yes, you've got to have someone who's been trained. St. Vincent's has someone who's been trained. There's a group in Sydney. I have no financial arrangement, but we do send off to histopath. They are the best detectors of parasites, especially Diff fragilis, from my experience.
A lot of people, I believe, are misdiagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Do you know that why that happens?
Right, because irritable bowel syndrome can mimic completely a chronic infection with blastocystis or diatomeba or both. So if you have someone who has irritable bowel syndrome, especially diarrhea predominant, then you should do a stool test asking, do we have these parasites present?
Okay, so most labs would be able to detect that?
The ones I mentioned do. The biggest ones don't.
Wow.
It's interesting.
Is that a, you know, one arm tied behind the back at times?
No, it's just what interest you have in diagnosing various things. And if your stool kits contain a fixative is crucial. Otherwise, the bacteria eat up the parasites in an unfixed specimen jar.
I believe there's been quite a bit of debate over the years about whether or not these two are pathogenic. What does that mean?
Well, there is no question about Diff fragilis being pathogenic, but as I grew up through gastroenterology, I was not mentored on parasite detection. When we thought of parasites, the first parasite that came to our mind was Giardia lamblia, which is a third rare, you know, down the bottom of the page, very rare in this country, although we've been taught by companies that produce drugs to treat them to start straight away, diagnose it clinically, someone's had diarrhea, I bet you've got Giardia. But when you do that stool test, it's not there. Diff fragilis has not been studied as much, but more recently it's now accepted in many hospitals, many infectious diseases specialists, as having at least 3 out of the 9 strains of blastocystis as being pathogenic, which means that if you remove the bug, the patient gets better.
Yeah. How do we find sufferers have been treated through the years? Do some people find that they've not had their problems taken seriously?
That's very true. And there are websites about this, and they're told that it is not related to their symptoms, that it is non-pathogenic, or they're simply given a course of flagyl, which is the worst thing you can do, because there was a paper recently published, 10 out of 10 patients treated with flagyl just develop more resistant parasites. So
right.
That is a contraindication. Do not use flagyl in those two parasites.
Do doctors know that?
No.
Is this a problem?
Yes.
Can some of us host the parasite without having any obvious symptoms?
Absolutely. So there are asymptomatic carriers.
Yes.
I can't tell you the percentage because we've never gone looking for a survey. In gastroenterology, we have a habit of aspirating, sucking up the fluid when we do a colonoscopy. And we would pick up in a week at least 10 different patients with the parasites, which is a large number. I mean, I'll find maybe 10 Giardia through the whole year. But here we're finding 10 blastos or diatomeba in a week. So if you keep looking for it, you'll find that if you just do a colonoscopy, take photographs and get out and tell the patient you don't have cancer, you don't have polyps, but they have mild IBS symptoms, then they may have failed to do you a good service and find the parasite.
Are we in danger of developing antibiotic resistance as doctors try to cure these bugs using antibiotics that that aren't successful? That seems to be the main thrust of how GPs deal with it.
Yes, you tend to develop resistance if you use a single antibiotic. And we've learned now that to kill a bug you want to kill, you may require multiple antibiotics that block enzyme systems within that organism at once. And that means they will not multiply, they will not use alternative metabolic pathways to get around that molecule. Just as we do with tuberculosis, we use 3 drugs together, otherwise you get resistance. So that's lesson number one. Secondly, you've got to know something about it. The information is so well available now on Dr. Google. Look it up and ask someone if you don't know, but don't go and treat blindly by just giving a course of flagyl, believing that flagyl cures everything.
It's interesting. HIV obviously was very difficult to treat for a long period of time, and with just one thing in the armory, it was very, very hard to deal with. But now there are multiple varieties of it, and so therefore it's become easier to contain, and it's now something that people are living with rather than being claimed by. Is this part of the issue as far as dealing with these parasites are concerned, that we have sort of multiple things to target them?
It's a nice analogy, but it's slightly different because HIV is a virus. Mm. And viruses do not multiply unless they get inside a cell. But again, the same concept is applicable. Single antiviral, antiretroviral, you're going to develop ways around which this virus will get around. So they use combinations 3 and 4 to suppress the growth and multiplication. So virology is not my field because we don't have chronic viral infections in a gut, but that's a general principle. However, those drugs used for HIV do not interfere, and we don't interfere with the parasitic antibiotics in the HIV field.
Mm. What's your advice for anyone wondering if they might have these parasites? What would they be feeling for a start?
Well, they'll be feeling irritable bowel syndrome type symptoms, which may be gas, cramping, urgency, diarrhea, bit of a bloat, non-specific symptoms that come and go. And what you'd want to do is to have a stool test done by a company that knows how to find Diphragilis and Blasto. Most find Blasto, most don't find Dientamoeba.
Are doctors aware that that's what they should be looking for?
I think that's why you have me on the show today. No. Mm.
It is obviously, you know, when you're in a specialist unit, you know, these people are knowing what they're searching for. But if you're a GP in a lone practice, it's sometimes hard to keep up with this sort of development, you know?
Well, actually, the GPs learn first because we send them patients back that have been treated. So I must take my hat off to the GPs of how rapidly they uptake new data, new information.
Mm.
But it's very difficult to teach the gastroenterologists, especially those who've recently graduated, and they are now an expert. And it's very hard to teach young dogs old tricks.
Yep, exactly. Nice line. How would you advise travellers going overseas to avoid picking up these parasites? You know, we, as Australians, because of the strength of the currency, have been travelling very widely. I think 8 million of us go overseas every year. So it's one of those situations where, you know, we are in the firing line, you know, particularly in third world environments.
Well, it's very difficult to prevent catching something, but if you can, this is another throwaway line, make sure you have alcohol with every meal. It gives you alcohol and acid, and it destroys those incoming bugs. But essentially, you know, you want to drink water that is pure. And, it, you know, in some countries, you might go to some, and I can't speak from experience, African country, and you may not have even bottled water that is pure. So I can't speak for that.
Yes.
But it would seem to me that those waters which are not running tap water, but bottled water or canned drinks would be the ones to use. Again, things like salads that have been washed and have tap water on them, then you call that suspect. And apart from that, I mean, it's just common sense, maybe. Yeah.
So try and eat hot food if you can, you know, so that it has been solidly cooked. And I suppose cleanliness is very important, making sure you wash your hands all the time.
Wash your hands and don't drink tap water, but rather bottled water. Even brushing your teeth will be better with bottled water rather than running tapped water in some of the places people visit.
Yeah. I guess Foreign Affairs might have an alert. But, you know, I suppose you probably understand yourself, you know, which third world countries you're dealing with. And I saw some reports the other day about just some of the main rivers in China and how polluted they are. And, you know, even a country that is on the rise like China has obviously a huge issue with this sort of thing.
I'm sure you could walk on water over there.
What about Gardia? What we've certainly all heard about, you know, much more than the other two. How big a problem is that?
Well, Giardia lamblia is a parasite that invades the tissues of your small bowel, throughout the small bowel.
Yep.
And it actually alters the lining and changes the little villi, which shrink and you malabsorb. So you actually become deficient in B12, folic acid, and you can develop anemia. It can be quite chronic, long-standing, and you become quite ill. And it is not common. I mean, I mentioned I might see 10 in a year. But what I'm seeing more and more of Giardia is that it's so difficult to clear up with the standard drug that we've been taught works in most cases, like high-dose metronidazole, Flagyl,
yep,
or Fasigen. So we are now sent cases, because we've got a bit of a parasite name, that have been treated two or three or four times. And we've got to design protocols with imported medications from the US and sometimes from Europe to try and block as many enzymes of that bug to clear up the infection. I mean, I have a patient who we cannot cure of his Giardia lamblia. And so he has an ongoing treatment with medication to suppress its multiplication so that his lining can regrow the villi, the tiny little projections that absorb your food and nutrients.
So is it just because this particular strain you've not come across before? Is that essentially why you find it hard to defeat?
Usually it's because that person was treated with single drugs on numerous occasions, and the bug has developed the capacity to metabolize anything. Mm-hmm. So once you've failed, it's like with Helicobacter in the stomach, don't keep on using the same therapy that you used before and expect a different result. I always recall that as being one of the definitions of stupidity.
Well, insanity, I think, is close to the mark. So if you, after two treatments, have had no success in defeating it, it's time to look further as to exactly what it is.
Ask someone that has treated resistant Giardia lamblia.
Are we also passing these parasites on domestically?
Probably not. Not that easily, unless you're very, very dirty.
Yeah. Do herbal treatments and probiotics help?
Not parasites.
Okay. What kind of role should they play in treating gut disorders?
Well, I can't speak to herbs. Herbs are actually drugs that we haven't yet purified, and many of our drugs come from herbs. Probiotics are living bacteria that, if you ingest, make a difference. And so we can buy a number of probiotics over the counter. None have been registered by the Therapeutic Goods Authority. They're all listed. That means they don't do anything, but they have no side effects. But probiotics can work in a small minority of people, and they can suppress a different bacterium that may be causing you an irritable bowel syndrome symptom. And so you may have less bloating, you may control your diarrhea a little bit, you might defecate better. But generally speaking, in the medical world, probiotics have not found a distinct place of usage. Perhaps one Saccharomyces boulardii or a brand of brewer's yeast can be helpful in some diarrheas.
An SMS from Beth. She says, my 78-year-old mum has had diarrhea since October of last year. She has dementia and has been in an aged care facility for the last 2 months. Her GP has recently prescribed steroids, believing the diarrhea could be caused by an inflamed bowel. She believes colonoscopy would be of assistance, but difficult due to mum's fragile state. Mum is losing weight and has little appetite. Any advice from your expert would be greatly appreciated. It's a bit hard to do a diagnosis over the phone. Yeah,
I mean, we diagnose over the phone every day, as you can see. Mm. No, people ask,
I know,
and we have to help out. But in a person who's 78, they're not 98, and they're losing weight, I think it would be reasonable minimally to at least have a stool test done by a place that does detect, such as histopath. A GP can do this. But that patient who's losing weight and has diarrhea has had a change in bowel habit, and technically the correct thing to do would be to attempt even a short colonoscopy, to look inside, collect the stool while it's warm inside.
I hope that helps, Beth. Joe the Truckie says, I have Crohn's disease. Can that possibly be misdiagnosed going on what you've spoken about?
If she has been...
Joe, this is Joe the Truckie.
Sorry.
He.
If he has been diagnosed with Crohn's disease, most likely he has been diagnosed through a colonoscopy, and that diagnosis will be firm. But we have patients with Crohn's. We have probably the largest cohort in this country, over 900 now, that have superinfection. That means they can have D. fragilis on top of that, but especially a bug called Clostridium difficile, which superinfects Crohn's disease. And patients feel dramatically better, at least a sub-cohort, in whom you get rid of the C. difficile and the Crohn's disease is ever so much easier to manage. But again, it's hard to manage on the phone with so little information.
Mm. It's creating a bit of havoc, isn't it, in a number of overseas countries, this Clostridium.
Right. Clostridium difficile was under the radar sort of thing. But now it's come out and it's mainstream, especially in North America. An epidemic started around 2002 in Montreal, in a particular hospital where a strain had mutated, and it's now called the O27 epidemic strain. And this strain has around 20 to 30 times the amount of toxin. And it can cause overwhelming or fulminant Clostridium difficile colitis and death. In the United States, depends who you read, between 30 and 100,000 deaths occur from CDI, Clostridium difficile infection.
Wow.
Oh, it's huge.
That is extraordinary numbers.
It's more than the American soldiers died in Vietnam, but this is happening every year. So this epidemic spread into the United States, and now it co-infects ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And this is the reason, and that's a single reason, why fecal transplantation has now become mainstream, whereas before it was looked upon as an alternative, because it's the only thing that cures relapsing Clostridium difficile.
How does it spread, do we know?
Well, it's, again, it's through fomites, through things you touch. So a person who has C. difficile, if you have a suction device 5 to 7 centimeters away from them, you can pick up in the air around them, or even in the toilet when they're about to flush, this cloud of C. difficile comes up. It's scary. And, of course, in the room where the patient is kept in a hospital, you can culture it from curtains, from door handles, from the end of the bed. That's why people wear gloves to walk into this situation. But if your bowel flora has not been damaged by antibiotics, you're much less likely to catch it, except this epidemic strain, which you can catch whether you have had antibiotics or not. So, again, it's scary. And they're coming out to Australia overseas on aircraft.
This is the real problem. I mean, we used to have the tyranny of distance to protect us, but these days we're, you know, 13 hours away by direct flight from the West Coast, and so therefore very vulnerable to it. It's obviously spread to Australia.
It has already spread in Australia. Medical Journal of Australia writers have already mentioned that we do have an epidemic. There have been a number of deaths, not that many yet, but you don't want to have even, we think we have had 20 in Sydney and 20 in Melbourne, but there are many more infected that keep on having chronic relapsing diarrhea. They lose 10, 15 kilograms of weight. It usually affects the elderly, and they are brought in for us to do a fecal transplant, and the poor patient looks as if they have escaped from a concentration camp. They're so thin.
What can be done to treat it? Do we know?
Well, prevention is the best thing, so reduction in antibiotic usage. But the earlier you treat the underlying condition, which is the damaged flora, damaged bacteria that have been damaged by antibiotics, and a single implant of human flora from somebody else replaces and recolonizes the missing components that are damaged by use of antibiotics.
Scary, isn't it? It's one of those things where, you know, obviously we're not picking up a lot of these things as well, which is the thing that is causing most concern, I think. We're talking tonight parasites, bugs and antibiotics. Professor Tom Barodi with us tonight, the Centre for Digestive Diseases. And I'm wondering whether you'd like to join us. Perhaps there's been an issue in yourself and your family. Perhaps there are some concerns about things that just aren't improving, and you're wondering whether that we could have another issue brewing that you're not fully aware of. If you'd like to join us, we'd love you to.
Tony Delroy's Nightlife.
In studio tonight, one of our leading gastroenterologists, Professor Tom Barodi, and we're talking tonight about parasites, bugs and antibiotics. And we're about to go to your calls. Should just tell you, Monday night football final, it was the Sydney Roosters over the West Tigers, 56-14 at the Sydney Football Stadium. Danny, you're asking, what do you recommend when triple therapy doesn't work first time?
Yeah, thanks. We live in the Byron Shire, and there's a lot of friends up here that seem to have blasto and have tried all their herbal and alternate remedies, and then have been down to Sydney to Professor Brody's centre and have tried the triple therapy, but have found it really hasn't helped. They had really bad side effects during the process, and then following that, they just had either repeat or no sign of change. So, just what recommendations he might have beyond that?
This is the triple therapy for which parasite?
For blastocystis.
And is the blastocystis gone from your stool, but you still have symptoms?
Yep. Well, I don't have symptoms personally, but people here who have, I've been diagnosed with BASTA and I'm fine with it, but people who have had the triple therapy have had your combination or the cocktail, as they call it, and they equate it to like a nuclear bomb in the stomach, which gets rid of everything there, and then afterwards they've had no change in the BASTA measurement. In fact, some of it's progressed to go into worse. So what would you recommend beyond that?
Right, so around 80% are cured with the three drugs together on a series of about 300 patients we have done. But it's how it just shows you how difficult it is to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So having had this pointing at us for a long time, we had a doctor come to see us. I'll tell you a quick story. Mm. Who went to Morocco, and he's self-treated. And we've always been taught, if you treat yourself, you have a fool for a doctor. But he did not get rid of it. First drug, second drug, third drug. And then he tried two together and three together. Then he came over to ask me what to do. And I didn't know what to do. So I said, look, why don't you give yourself higher concentration enemas at home? You know how to do this. And lo and behold, he cured himself. So we decided that on the back of this doctor's ability to cure himself with high concentration of the three drugs, but we use different ones that haven't been used before, we've developed a transcolonoscopic infusion, which gives us around 98% cure rate in the last 250 or so patients. So that's what we use for failures orally, and they come in for a day, the patient's sedated, they have the bowels washed out like a normal colonoscopy, and then we infuse about three times a dose. And it doesn't have much in terms of side effects. Occasionally you get nausea. We follow on with 10 days of nitazoxanide, which covers the small bowel. And we've been so impressed with the ability to cure this. And we've published this as abstract so far and soon be published as a paper. But that's the current state of play.
Yeah, all right, Danny, good luck with that. That's what's in play. Gay, your daughter has had stabbing pains after returning from the United States.
Yeah, she just returned yesterday, but the last 6 weeks in New York, she's had stabbing pains that don't seem to come after eating, and then intermittent diarrhea that comes whenever it feels like coming. So I'm worried about it. I've put her on Flagyl now. I'm really worried that that's not the right thing to do. So should I just get to a gastroenterologist, or what should I do?
Tom?
Yeah, well, it's helpful.
She's 24.
Helpful to have a stool test before we interfere with the flora, because now you may not find a bug that'll be there in resistant but lower levels. But you still should do a stool test. Sometimes you're quite surprised what you find in there. Mm. But it's clear that she's picked up something. The bug lives in her bowel. It manufactures neurotoxins, which gives our bowel the message, hey, I've got a cramp, I've got to go and pass wind and stool.
Yes. Yes.
So she has got an infection ongoing. So what we would do is we'd do stool test. If we find something, we treat it. If we don't find something, we treat it with what we call a blunderbuss approach, that we use several antibacterial agents simultaneously, such as rifaximin, vancomycin, non-absorb, so they don't enter the body. They go down the toilet and they treat the infected stool.
Great. Now, just one thing I want to ask is, I've only had her on the Flagyl for a day. Should I take her straight off it?
I suggest you take it straight off. It takes three days, let it regrow, and do a stool test.
All right, Gay. Thanks for the call. Anne, you're asking, does gut flora link with autism?
That's exactly right. There's I saw a thing on the ABC that maybe there was some connection. I was wondering if the professor has any information about that, please.
Okay, well, that's a well-known connection, mostly driven by Professor Feingold in Los Angeles. He's a good friend.
Oh, good.
And the observation was made that the regressive autism children, the ones that may have had antibiotics at a very early age for ear infections, and they tend to crawl around and pick up some bugs, and those bugs colonize the bowel and produce neurotoxins, as many Clostridia do. I think the listeners will know Clostridium tetani, which is tetanus, Clostridium difficile, which produces neurotoxins, Clostridium perfringens and botulinum. And they are particularly little nasty bugs that produce neurotoxins that can actually travel up your vagus nerve. And so in autism, the theory goes, this is Feingold and Bolte. Ellen Bolte actually brought her son to Feingold, and he now has named the Clostridium after her because she noticed that vancomycin changes the baby's behavior. And how can it change a behavior when it's not absorbed? So clearly it must work on the bug in the stool. So the current working theory is that autism in the regressive autism children is caused by either Clostridium Bolte or a bugs called Disulfa vibrio. And there's several of those, and the toxins, either through the bloodstream or up the vagus nerve, affect the speech area. You lose your words. They affect the occipital visual area, and the child can't see mummy and therefore has no eye contact. Repetitive movements, behavioural changes, and that we define as autism or autism spectrum.
Wow, that's so interesting. Thank you very much indeed.
All right, Anne, thank you. Jodie, you actually had a reaction to the conversation tonight as well.
Yes, I did. I'm just sitting here writing an essay for uni, and I was listening, and I thought, this is me. Well, I've had years of trouble with diarrhea, and I've had many colonoscopies, and I've had a fundoplication, and I still, whenever I eat anything, I feel sick, and everything seems to just pass through.
Hey, poor thing. So you had a fundoplication because you had a large-ish hiatal hernia with reflux, I guess.
Chronic reflux.
But
yes.
The diarrhea and the nausea are caused. And I'm giving broad strokes here, so nothing applies 100%, I hope the listeners realise.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But generally speaking.
And lots of bloating too.
Trapping of wind inside your small bowel, which is quite long. So diarrhoea is usually caused by an infective agent. You've had colonoscopies, which means you do not have a visible structural abnormality or colitis. So the working hypothesis is that your stool is infected with something, which we can either culture or not culture. There are nearly 3.3 million different genes inside our stool. Our body has 25,000. So it just shows you how complex the flora is. When you walk into a room, you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this infected stool with something that can be hidden but is there will spin off toxins into the bloodstream. And it spins off toxins into your bowel wall, which oozes water. We call that diarrhea. Nausea is the absorption of these toxins into the bloodstream, and it's experienced in your vestibular nuclei in the brain, and that's what gives you the nausea sensation. But to approach it from a sort of a scientific way, you would like to do some cultures. If you find a bug, you target the bug. If you don't, you do a broad-spectrum approach to suppress the bacteria, which gives us around 80% suppression with vancomycin, rifaximin, or streptomycin orally. So it's treat the bug that's inside your poo.
Yes, I've felt like there's something. I feel like I've got a ball of rotten meat inside me all the time. I just feel unwell all the time. I've lost tons of weight, and I feel like I'm sick of going to the doctor and saying, what's wrong with me?
Which a lot of people feel the way you describe your symptoms. And it's a sad situation because at university, I was never taught this. So you have to have a sort of imaginitis, as I call it, to see that you have to put yourself inside the colon and ask a question, what is happening inside the lumen of the bowel? That means in the center of in the stool itself. So I call it triple S or sick poo syndrome. The poo is sick.
Should Jodie do?
Well, I think she should have someone who will do stool tests and look for Clostridium difficile, look for parasites, look for even for chronic Campylobacter. That can cause weight loss. And if you identify a target, it makes it easier. But if not, you'd need to have someone like our team does where we actually treat the, presumed infection. Mm. And then the treatment response gives us an insight into what you've got.
All right. Good luck, Jodie. Katie, your husband was one of Tom's first patients for the fecal transplant.
That's right, Dr. Brody. Hi, it's Katie Stitt, Peter Stitt's wife. How are you?
I can't believe it.
I can't believe it either. As soon as I heard you talking, I said, that's got to be Dr. Brody.
Goodness.
And then I heard, so I wanted to call and say,
I
know, me too. You changed our lives because after you and Peter trialled the fecal transplant, you know, he did it all weapon in the hospital. And now it's mainstream. It's saving people's lives. And when I met him, he had ulcerative colitis for 7 years and was practically dying. And after that, he has been 100% perfect for 15 years.
I don't know why he's so well, because I was so afraid when he went to India. Remember, he went to India?
Right.
And I thought, oh, no, he got rid of his colitis miraculously, because I had no idea we were going to fix him. And he goes to India to get some more. Well, if you do talk to him, pass on my kindest regards to
we're
Peter.
Yes, we're happily married. We have three beautiful daughters, and we've moved back to Forbes. So thank you very much. And all the travelling he's done, we've been through Brazil and India, and he's never looked back. He's been 100%. 100% well, and thank you for saving his life.
Well, thank you for calling in. That's so lovely.
That's good news. Thanks, Katie. Dean, you're wondering, how do these kind of conditions impact pregnancy?
Yeah, correct. Yep.
Hmm. Look, I don't deal with a lot of pregnancy, but generally speaking, pregnancy tends to survive everything. So,
yeah,
it's the pregnancy tends to give you constipation. These give you diarrhoea, so it kind of cancels it out a little bit. But yes, you can suffer more through pregnancy. You can end up having more nausea with some of these bugs. But there is no specific textbook on parasites in pregnancy. However, if you were to live in a parasite land, which I used to live in the Solomon Islands, there are different parasites, Ascaris lumbricoides, Trichuris trichuria, Ankylostoma duodenale. They affect pregnancy, but in Australia, it's much less so.
Yeah, right, okay.
All right, Dean, thanks for the call. Graeme, you were wondering why Cryptosporidium is so hard to kill.
Yes, I am, Tony, Good evening, Professor.
Evening.
Tom, any theories about that?
Well, Cryptosporidium generally occurs in people who have immune compromisation. And we don't see that very much because we don't deal with people. Unless you're on steroids or Imuran or have HIV, Cryptosporidium's hard. Generally speaking, it cures itself. You may have read about that.
Well, I've only dealt with it as a waterborne issue, Tom.
Oh, I see.
That was Charlie. I was involved in the pool industry for many years.
You're in the pool industry? I'm in the poo industry.
Yeah, we're very close, mate. I think mine was a... I won't use that analogy on the radio, but I was... we had issues. We always, according to Australian medical guidelines, you had to maintain a free chlorine level of 20 parts per million for 8 hours.
Right.
To kill the Cryptosporidium in the water. Now,
that's a topic you will know far more about than I ever will.
Okay, but see, we also found out quite by accident that by mixing liquid chlorine and hydrogen peroxide with and water creates ozone, which killed off the Cryptosporidium very rapidly.
Yeah, I mean, you use pool ozone machines that sterilise the pool so much better than simply using chlorine. True.
Yeah, exactly right. And that kills off the Cryptosporidium and Giardia. But in saying that, we can't get that changed. The Australian Medical Association still requires the 20 parts per million of free chlorine over that period of time.
Well,
I'd say through clinical trials, I would imagine.
Well, I think if you show evidence that if you can chlorinate and ozonate water and it does better than chlorine alone, then ultimately you'll change the minds of the people who write the rules. I mean, we actually use an ozone generator to pump ozone into people's bowels to kill anaerobic bacteria, and it works in some, doesn't work in others, but in HIV, MAC-associated, Mycobacterium avium complex-associated diarrhea, a gentleman, Carpenter, published this about 10 years ago, and that's the reason why we got ozone machines to treat patients who've got severe Crohn's. And we use hyperbaric oxygen in patients who have fistulae, again, by the same system of oxidizing the bacteria that will not die with antibiotics.
Yeah, Graeme, thanks so much for the call. Rachel, your husband's had ongoing issues for almost a decade.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know where to start, really. About 10 years ago, my husband was working over in Thailand, and he came to Australia, and he started to get quite ill. We've spent so much time going to doctors and telling of his symptoms and everything, and to be told that it's all in his head. Probably about 2.5 years after we started going to the doctors to try and find out what was going on, he was told that he had Giardia, and he was given Flagyl. But it just doesn't seem to have cleared it up in any way. So he's had stool tests, he's had countless colonoscopies, he's been given Flagyl again over the years, and we just definitely know that there's something going on. There has to be some sort of parasite. He loses lots of weight. Just lots of weight. Again, with the stool before, he was saying that lots of diarrhea, and it's almost like it is IBS, but I do believe that there's a parasite, and I was just curious if you had any sort of direction that perhaps we should go through?
Well, thank you for that. General direction is that he probably has an undetectable bacterium, except that you mentioned the word Thailand. And I can't quote you at the moment. I'd have to look up because I can't remember everything in that brain of mine. But there is a particular rare parasite which is found in Thailand that actually penetrates the skin and small bowel, and you have to do a special test for it, which I do not remember right now. But I've had two patients with it. And when you mentioned Thailand, I thought of it straight away. But yes, there are infectious diseases. I'm not an infectious diseases expert, but gastroenterologists deal with a lot of infective agents because they deal with guts. So we come across these, but if he's losing weight and has diarrhea, it's an organic illness. It has to be investigated by people who think in terms of bugs in the guts that are not visible, as well as bugs that are. And sometimes a trial of treatment by suppression of Clostridia. Like, we know perfringens is present in elderly people with diarrhea, but unless you have a student who's doing his PhD and he develops the assay for it, which we did with a gentleman from Concord who did about 100 patients, and 85% had Clostridium perfringens. Now, I can't get a laboratory to test for it because it means that it's not reimbursed by Medicare. Someone's got to set it up. Who'll pay for it? And we suffer from that problem in many areas in stool where you cannot send a stool away and be tested like blood can be, because you need to send it to the States, either do pyrosequencing, DNA extraction, and it costs around $10,000 to do an assay of stool. And at the end of the day, all you get is an array rather than a specific list, like a shopping list of what's in there. So we're not quite there with the data, but I think you need some specialized thinking and investigation behind the investigator.
Okay.
So, Rachel, can you get one of those tests arranged? Or
I can certainly investigate and do a bit of research to get something done. It's just been one of those things that's been so ongoing for so long.
For 10 years, I mean, it's just incredible.
Crazy. Yeah, absolutely. And I think the worst part about it is when you go to your GP and you're at a state where you really have no idea what's going on. It's in your head.
Rachel, will you hang on and I'll get you to have a word with Tom off air?
Sure, thank you.
Okay, just hang in and we'll get some information to you. You know, 10 years is insane. Tom, thanks so much for being there tonight. I really appreciate it. I'm terribly sorry we've got a board full of calls, but we, you know, at least covered some of the area tonight. And thanks for your explanations.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for having me here tonight.
Professor Tom Barodi, Centre for Digestive Diseases.